Do you want to know about the operas that I've been doing with Philip
But the what?
Glass? Opera with Philip Glass. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I'd rather talk about you.
Well, it is me. I've done an opera with him.
Oh, you did an opera with Philip
yeah.
Glass? No, well, indeed. Tell me about it.
Well, it's an opera based on one of my books, which is opening in Houston next month, and we're going down to rehearse on Monday next week to Houston, to the Opera House.
Have you been to Houston before?
No, never. That'll be an experience. Have you?
Yes, in fact, I grew up in Houston.
Did you?
And I have relatives there. My father still lives there. You're going to find it very hot.
You're going to explain to me, please, why all these tunnels are underneath Houston? People keep saying, what about all these tunnels underneath Houston?
Well, they're not really tunnels. What they are passageways, very much like the passageways into Rockefeller Center. They interconnect the various skyscrapers much in the way that the passageways connect the buildings in Toronto, in Montreal, where it's so cold that it's easy to
see.
Go. They're almost like underground sidewalks.
Are they used for anything, like shops down there or cafes or anything?
But I can tell you they're air-conditioned.
Oh, they are?
Yes.
Oh, that's why people go down there.
Houston is a very friendly and a very impersonal city. It's impersonal because there isn't the great deal of interaction the way you would find in London or in New York. People drive. And they'll go from an air-conditioned house in an air-conditioned car to an air-conditioned shopping mall. The restaurants are all in shopping centers, and the highways are loaded with franchises. It will be a culture shock, no doubt.
I was brought up in Rhodesia. I mean, certain aspects of it won't be a shock.
Rhodesia, yes. You were born in what was known as Persia, Iran now. How did that happen? Well, I know how it happened.
Well, my father was working for what was then called the Imperial Bank of Persia, which is quite sweet in itself. Because in those days the Brits had banking and commerce and the French had, their great power shared out Persia. And then, of course, there was this coup and a sergeant, the father of the ex-Shah, made a coup. And this prison that the Shah has just been thrown out was the son of a army sergeant or something.
How long did you live in Persia?
5 years.
So you probably don't have too much of a recollection of it, do you?
Well, I do have little, the kind of snapshots you have. And also when I went to Pakistan last year, what came back, the smells, you know how smells affect you. And there are plenty of them, I have to tell you.
What was it like growing up in southern Rhodesia?
What was it like?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've written about it so much.
Well, tell our listeners.
I was, the chief... Oh, we're on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought we were having a chat.
We are. Let me explain how I do this so that you're not confounded. We can talk in a very informal way because I take the raw material and I edit it into 2-minute... features that run in New York. The broadcast runs 15 times a week, all about books, mostly with a literary thrust. So this way we can talk very casually and not to print before the cameras or worry about the clock, except for our own schedule. What's that?
It's wonderful.
Yeah. So and then I can also control the broadcast because I splice it together. I use a razor blade, splicing tape, and a word processor to write words around it. And I use the interview material very much like a columnist will use a quote.
Mm-hmm.
So it works out rather nicely. There's not too much like this in America. I'm not sure about England, but there are very few broadcasts that focus on literature and good writing. So that's why I wanted to have, I wanted you to share with the people who will be hearing this a little bit about yourself so that they would have at least a glimpse of you as you prepare to become a writer.
Well, I think perhaps one thing that recently discovered is pretty important is that before I was just over 5, I moved from inside Iran, from Kermanshah to Tehran, and then the family came to England through the Soviet Union. We were the first family to travel after the revolution as travelers in the Soviet Union, up to Leningrad, through the Baltic States, to England, where I was for 6 months, and which I remember with cold horror. I hated it so much. Everything grey, dingy. And then a slow boat, a German slow boat, all the way around Africa to Bara, and up the slow train to what is now Harare, and then, you know that kind of ox wagon you see in your films of the Midwest? Well, we went to the farm in one of those, and I remember very clearly lying with 16 oxen and the driver with a whip, which they make crack just half an inch above the backs of the oxen, but never touch them. Absolute masters of the whip, these people. And I remember lying in bed in the ox wagon, seeing the hurricane lamps swinging back and forth, going into the unknown, which it was for us, and then the farm, which was virgin bush. Which was an extraordinary childhood. Which, of course, when you're having a childhood, you don't think this is an extraordinary childhood. But my brother and I, who were discussing it not long ago, and saying the tragedy was, my mother's heart was broken because he and I were not given this proper education suitable for middle-class English brats, like, well, you know, proper schools in England, instead of which we were roaming wild on the veldt with a tutu rifle. Shooting for the pot.
Did you read a lot as a child?
Yes, a great deal.
I just did an interview with Penelope Lively, who won the Booker Prize last year. And she grew up in Egypt, and she did not have a formal education. She had a governess who actually had only quit school when she was 15, but her education until she was in her early adolescence was informal at home, and subsisted mostly on books, which she now says was a wonderful beginning for her. She didn't think so at the time.
Well, I thought school wasn't all that important to me, except it was not a good experience. You know, I was sent away from home at the age of 7 to boarding school because it was essential. You know, there were no schools on the farm, of course, but it didn't do me any good. But I left school when I was 14. I just dropped out, the phrase now is. And I really did educate myself by books. And it has enormous advantages and great disadvantages, because I would love now to have maths, for example.
I'm sorry to have?
Maths, you call it in the singular, maths, mathematics.
Oh, math, yes.
I would love to have that, and I would love to have languages. But on the other hand, you do have... you don't have certain prejudices that I would have had if I'd been a middle-class child in England.
At what point in your life did you decide that you had to write?
I don't know, I sort of drifted into it because I just wrote. And then, it's very hard to remember. I wrote two novels when I was 16, which were pretty awful, and I'm glad Sir tore them up. Otherwise, of course, they'd now be the subject of 1,000 theses. And then I didn't write again until I was in my 20s, late 20s, properly. By which time I knew I was going to be a writer. I'd written a lot of short stories. Some of them not too good. That's how, I think people drift into things.
You certainly don't run out of things to say. You've covered every topic, every theme, and you've had something like 35 books.
So they keep telling me, are you sure they're not just collections of short stories coming out under different names? Because sometimes this happens.
No.
I could have a look.
I don't think so. But
I don't think it's 35. Just let me have a look at that.
Sure.
I don't think that...
Do you remember... you've written these books, but do you remember vividly what's in each of these books? Or does your memory have to be jarred?
Of course I remember. Well, two of these books, you see, actually are part of other collections, so we can reduce it by a bit.
reduce it by two.
This, of course, I remember very clearly, what, particularly as from time to time you have to revise them for republication.
Mm-hmm.
Now you think, good God, did I really write that?
Well, you went to boarding school, this was in Rhodesia.
Yes.
How did you, what took you to England?
Oh, I would have come to England when I was 19, only the war started. I always wanted to come to England because it was if you are not orientated towards sport and the sundowner, it is a very boring country. And it still is a very boring country, I hate to say, because when I went back in 1982, I remembered why I'd left. I mean, if you're in the bush, out in the country, it is so beautiful, that's okay. But in the towns, on the verandas, the tedium of it, all conversations center around, it used to center around the deficiencies of the blacks. Now it centers around black-white politics. No one ever talks about anything else, no one ever reads anything, and you just go frantic with tedium. But I think I'm going back at the end of the year, actually, to just smell the place again, you know.
Mm. So you have lived in England for how long?
Since 1949.
Well, let's jump ahead a little bit, since I it's going to be hard to question you about each and every book, so that it's not feasible. But let's start, there are three latest books. The Good Terrorist, The Fifth Child, and of course your Afghanistan book. Let's start with The Fifth Child. This was a book that was chilling to me. I think some of the reviewers were wrong when they described it as a horror book or something akin to Rosemary's Baby. So tell me how this character evolved and what gave you the idea for The Fifth Child.
Well, there were a variety of ideas. The first idea was one I've had for many years, that when we talk about the little people or dwarves or fairies or elves and all that, it could just possibly be at some time in this earth smaller races lived, and this is how we remember them, in this stylized fashion. This is just a question, it's not what I believe, it's a possibility. So this is all, I've always had this idea, and then I read an essay by one of your writers who I think is fabulous, no one ever seems to read him, Lauren Isley, the essayist, who writes about the past of America physically, and he wrote the end of an essay with something like this, how he was going up from the seashore, and I think it was in Maine, and on a country road he saw this girl who turned her head, and he saw the flaring eyebrow ridges and the back of the head, and he said, my God, that is a Neanderthal girl. Went to talk to her, found her a simple ordinary country girl, and realized that she could have lived all her life in that community and no one ever have said anything. Our poor Maureen has a funny head. And then she turned and walked away from him in the dusk up towards a light burning. And he said to himself, this scene could have happened any time in the last, let's say, 200,000 years. This got to me. And I thought, what about all the races that might be in us and we don't know anything about? I mean, you can read essays saying that we have Cro-Magnon genes, Neanderthal genes, and we don't know it because they must be somewhere around. So that was one idea, but another impulse, it hit me hard, and you'll appreciate this with your history of a child. I read a letter in a magazine which went something like this. It's not exactly how it went. And it was all in theological language, which is what really amazed me. This girl said, I am writing you this letter not because I want any sympathy or help. I just want to share this with somebody. I have so many children I've gotten. And then this little girl was born, and from the moment she was born, our life has been hell. She was born a devil. She enjoys tormenting people. She enjoys hurting people. That if you're alone, no one can be alone in the room with her without her tormenting and destroying, and so on and so on. And at night, I go into her room and I see this innocent little face asleep on the pillow, and I yearn to put my arms around her, which I can never do when she's awake, and I daren't because I know that what would come up into my arms would be a spitting, fighting little devil. Yours sincerely, etc. And I suddenly thought what it must be like to be landed with a child who's just uncivilizable. You might say something about this, isn't it?
You've right. What prompted this woman to write to you?
Not to me. It went to a letter to a magazine, and I read it.
Yes. I see.
Oh, not to me. Okay. And I thought, and then these ideas just got married together, the way these ideas do get married together, and you're right.
Yeah, I don't understand it. Why in a household you can have perfectly civilized people, but one person acts in an aberrational manner. Mm. I don't know.
And the whole thing gets destroyed. It's ruined.
Tremendous impact and bringing down the whole family in a variety of ways. For example, the mother in the fifth child actually goes up to this hospital or institution and brings the boy back home. Now, she obviously had this maternal instinct that compelled her to do it. Was this a good thing for her to do? I don't know, but it was something that she had no control over. Mothers are like that.
Well, this is, after all, the heart of the book, isn't it? It's an unsolvable moral dilemma. That's the point, because to leave the child there meant she would know the child was, in fact, being murdered there. And if she she took the child home, and her family was destroyed. So there isn't a good solution, there isn't a moral solution to it. Which is why I think some people have been upset, because I'm convinced that we can't stand things that we think we can't solve. We need to be able to solve something.
I see a correlation between the boy and the fifth child and the girl who is your leading character in The Good Terrorist. Both the boy and the girl is 36 in The Good Terrorist, and not really a girl, but they're children who became outsiders within their family. Isn't that true?
See, I don't see this. I don't see the
Well, but the girl in The Good Terrorist.
But the girl is an extremely common type of girl. There are lots of people like that around.
No, but she became an outsider. She alienated her mother and father, who didn't really want to see her again. She robbed them, stole from them, exploited them in many respects, in much the same way as the boy and the fifth child. But for different reasons. I don't think the boy and the fifth child had any control over his impulses. The girl had some sort of philosophical base, although a flimsy one, but it was a philosophical base. But they both acted in a negative behavior, a negative pattern that alienated them from their parents.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What do you think, in equating these two, what have you added to what could be said about either Ben and the first child or the girl, Alice? I mean, you haven't said anything about either of them when you do that. I think, if I can elaborate, I think this is people who've had a certain literary education often do this. Almost the first sentence I get in practically most interviews will be, the character in so-and-so, or the theme in so-and-so, is it not exactly the same as the theme and characters in, I don't know what, some other book I've written? Or some other book I haven't written? And I can never understand what is the point of this, because it doesn't say anything about either. It doesn't help anything.
Yes, it does. We're talking about children in families who alienated their families or became outsiders. They did it for different reasons, but they did it. So you're talking about people who had gone their own way. In that way, you can identify them.
Ben had no choice, but this girl did have a choice. Alice has a choice. Ben has never had a choice.
Alan, that is very interesting. There is a trial. They have not gone to trial yet, but a group of terrorists were arrested. Was arrested in Washington, D.C. This past month. They had been...
I didn't know you had any.
Yes. This was a group of terrorists. 4 years ago, they robbed a Brink's armored car truck in Nyack, New York, and murdered two Brink's guards. One of them subsequently murdered a police officer in Queens while trying to escape. They've been underground. They've set off bombs. They set off a bomb at the U.S. Senate. They set off bombs all through New York City. They've staged a number of robberies. Almost all of them have been captured now. Many of them are in prison. One or two are still on the loose. The thing that baffled me about this group of terrorists, as well as the group of terrorists in your book, is that it was never very clear about their philosophy. I mean, the American terrorist would set off a bomb but never explain it. I'm not sure that the terrorist in your book explained it very well either, although they would say things like the imperialists, or they would be the typical communist rhetoric. But it was never. They never made alternatives very clear. They never showed me, in reading your book, how they would make the world better for us than what we had already.
To put it mildly. But, you know, can I sort of, it might seem going round in a circle a bit, but it isn't really. I had the most fantastic letters and meetings with people after writing The Good Terrorist than after any other book I've written. I was deluged with letters from people living in squats in various countries, people who'd been at the beginning of terrorist organisations like the Red Guards in Italy and so on and so on. And I really learnt quite a lot more about it than I ever knew when I started. And perhaps the most interesting, can I tell you about the most interesting of these encounters? I was in Rome and I met a woman whose husband had been killed a year before by a new wave of the Red Guards. And she had dealt with, she's an American woman, and she had dealt with her grief by visiting the first wave of the Red Guards in prison. Who, she described, now she said, the questions that are raised by all this are so enormous that she didn't know how to answer them, and I certainly don't. First, she said, all of that, she's talking about the first wave, all of them well-educated, most of the middle class, at the most lower middle class, nobody disadvantaged in any of these groups. They were all in very likable people. If you met them in a room, you would like them. They, all of them, had reverse conversions. Now they said things like, we cannot understand how we did the things we did. It was like being on a sailing ship under full sail and crashing into a reef. It was like being taken over by some outside force. All these, this type of remark they all came out with. There they sat in prison, I think most of them being released, writing diaries, writing memoirs, learning languages. They turned the place into a kind of university. Now, various interesting things about that. First is that none of them were disadvantaged. They couldn't really say why they'd done it. But they all said, inside these groups, they talk this kind of debased political revolutionary language like I use in The Good Terrorist, which they then became ashamed of. And one of them said, now the phrase really fascinating, it was as if we were taken over by the rhetoric we used. So, of course, the extension of that thought is, what other forms of language are we used by instead of using? I mean, people who, quite ordinary people. And the other interesting thing she said was this, that the people in prison who are psychologically in best health, who were coping with themselves, were those who had done the bad things. It was they who had actually shot the gun, set off the bomb or whatever. The people who were in a bad way were the ones who were sitting around full of self-pity saying things like, yes, but it wasn't me, I didn't actually fire the gun, I was only holding a hand grenade, it isn't fair. Which leads one on to think, as you might see, is it possible, I mean, how is it that someone, I'm not bringing it right, is it possible that someone who undertakes to go on a course of action and it's thoroughly wicked, to use an old-fashioned word, and actually does it and works through it, is in better shape than someone who thinks about it? This is a question, leaving it to the psychologist. And
I don't know. I don't even know if that's actually accurate. I'm not certain.
Neither do I. I don't know either.
I do know that the people who were active in the underground movements of the 1960s In fact, there was an article recently in the New York Times where they had a reunion at Columbia University, which was brought to a standstill by the anti-war protesters. In fact, I was a journalist at the time covering it and was almost killed by bricks. And
when was this?
This was in the late 1960s and early 1970s when there was a great deal of anti-war activism on the campuses.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these people who were active in that anti-war movement and who did indeed become members of the Weather Underground and organizations like that had a reunion last month at Columbia University. Most of them now have jobs on Wall Street.
Yeah.
There was peer pressure, there was a certain mass hysteria that led people to have these strong feelings, and it grew. I don't think anybody can explain it. But we're almost out of time, and an important aspect of your life is your feeling about Afghanistan. And in The Wind Blows Away Our Worlds, you're very hard on the Soviet Union in this book. And here the United States is trying so hard to be friendly with them. Reagan is over there in Moscow this week. And yet your concluding chapter, you talk about the genocide in the Soviet Union and to make comparisons with the killings in Germany. This must reflect your feeling about the war in Afghanistan.
Well, the war in Afghanistan has never been reported properly in the West. There are whole areas that have never been touched. It has been a terrible war. Genocide is a mild word for what has been going on. United Nations representatives have used that word for other people. They bomb villages flat, kill civilians. There are 1 million people being killed. There are 5 million bombs, the Trojan butterfly bombs scattered all over the place, which is going to make it very hard for people to go back. They killed off a whole generation of intellectuals. Have we ever protested? No. Precisely because of your attitude, one should be nice to the Soviet Union.
No, wait,
why?
I didn't say it was my attitude.
Attitude, very common. You do not criticize the Soviet Union. It's a hangover from the 30s, this attitude. And I have found coming out, when I was there, somebody said to me, you think when you come out they're going to be pleased to publish your articles and talk about Afghanistan. You're going to feel as if you're inside a rubber sack. Which was exactly what I felt like. It was like, and it still is sometimes, you come up against something like an invisible rubber wall. People do not want to know about it. There's a kind of psychological block, and of course it's an immensely complicated subject, but one reason is that we like, I think it's a historically rooted reason in our attitude towards the dreaded Saracens as well, because it's been there for so long. We like to see the Mujahideen as blood-stained fanatics beyond the pale of ordinary reason, which, of course, is a vast gamut of these men, ranging from the people like Khomeini and are horrible, really terrifying people, to liberals, you know, everything in between. They're immensely varied. Some of them are extremely well-informed. I mean, to go to Peshawar and talk to Mujahideen about foreign policy, with detailed knowledge of the foreign policy of the United States about Afghanistan, and then come, as I did, very soon after, to California, Portland, and talk to, these are highly educated people I was talking to, who literally hardly knew where Afghanistan was. I mean, this is a bit of a shock.
Well, there is a... nobody knows the Afghans. I mean, I don't know any Afghans.
They're remarkable people.
Nobody knows what the country is like. Nobody knows what the language
nobody
is like.
Nobody knows.
And as a result, there's this feeling, I think, well, who cares? Isn't that true?
Here, yes. I think... nobody cares, and I think it has been described as the worst tragedy of our time. Did you know there are 5 million refugees out of a population of 16 million?
Yes.
There are a million people being killed inside there. There are 2 million internal refugees. People have had to move out because their villages have been bombed flat and so on and so on. There are crops burned in the fields. It is a tragedy on, it's probably the worst tragedy in the world now. And a lot of people don't care about it. You can't talk to them about it because we have been nice to Begorbe, or to Gorby now, of course.
But the United States has imposed sanctions on the Soviet Union, trade sanctions, and did work to try to include as part of the arms agreement to have troop withdrawals by the Soviet Union. So the United States has worked to probably more than any other country to do something about that crime.
Yes, all this has changed recently. And I think the change was at the Battle of Hoste. I don't know if you remember that big battle, which was the first of the battles reported in any kind of depth, which was not the first of the battles, to put it mildly. And now the United States has made this deal, which, please God, will work. And then the Afghans can go back home. But this is why it's so terrible. It's because if you go to Afghanistan, to Peshawar, and see the miles and miles and miles of refugee camps, and you suddenly realize, right, this is what's going on in Ethiopia, Eritrea, Tigray, Mozambique. I'm not familiar with South America. God knows how many places, poor places in the world. Certainly in Brazil, where I've been recently. You suddenly have it hurts, you know.
There's this feeling that we're in a perpetual state of war.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
It's terrible, and so very little is being done about it, and I suppose so very little ultimately can be done about it.
Man hasn't done a very good job of stopping war, has he?
No.
Ever?
No.
Well, I guess we're going to have to wrap things. I want to ask you some of the dust has settled since you did your 5 space books. And, of course, you had your critics when you embarked upon this massive project. How do you respond to them, or is it necessary for a writer to ever have to respond to a critic?
I haven't finished it yet. I need to do Vol. 6 at some point. Well, you know, I have... I do have readers who read both, but a certain section of my readership will read only the realistic books, and another section will read only the... non-realistic books, and I find that very sad for both sides.
Well, the critics say, well, I like your down-to-earth books.
Well, you see, it's a prejudice. I really do think it's a prejudice. And this is, once again, we embark on a vast subject. The whole attitude towards space fiction and science fiction, I think, is a great pity, because this, I don't know if you read it at all, there's marvelous writing in that genre. Wonderful. Some of the best writing of our time. And yet people say, oh, I don't read that kind of thing. Well, it's a pity.
It is. Probably there are the people who remember Captain Video on television. I don't know if you ever saw that American show, but it was a very poorly done television broadcast done live with cardboard sets and cardboard characters. And so the science fiction got a bad name. However, there are ambitious works today with regard to science fiction and all these worlds that you created, and other people, Richard Adams and people like that, have created these marvelous worlds. So there is a demanding audience for it. I don't think that the science fiction fan today is going to take a poorly written book. I don't think it's going to sell.
No.
It would have to be a child who would read it.
Yeah.
Well, I really... I just... One other thing. We started talking about your opera.
Oh, yes.
Philip Glass. Did you do the lyrics or the book?
I did the libretto. We worked very closely together throughout. He, of course, had done the music and the designer and the director. We've all 4 worked very closely, and we will... off on Monday to the rehearsals in Houston. It's opening in a month. This is the making of the representative of Planet 8. And then we're going to start on the marriages between Zone 3, 4, and 5, which is probably for Chicago. It takes a long time to get an opera on. We started all this 4 years ago.
They have a beautiful opera house down there.
So I believe.
It's magnificent. You'll like that. Well, 45 minutes doesn't do you justice, Doris Lessing. There's so much to talk about, so much to explore, and it just can't be done in this limited amount of time. But I can assure you that you have a tremendous following on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. Just in coming in here this afternoon, you met a couple of them just on the way out, just casually, who know your work and love your work, as I do. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.